All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. This is the way to start this off. Start it right on the dime. Can only get better from here on out, all right? And that's a promise. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with filmmaker Morgan Neville about his brand new film, 20 Feet from Stardom. I got a chance to see that up at Sundance, did an interview with him, and it's a remarkable film and a really interesting interview, so stay tuned for that. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be welcoming back to the show Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and deputy secretary general of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Her most recent book is The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And she's currently working on a book about drones and targeted killing. Damn, there's a book that's got a huge amount of need for in society. Really pin that one down and lay bare what the hell is going on with all that. And we're going to be talking with Marjorie about the latest crime of the Obama gang. And this whole question of the what's come to light of the massive spying on you, me, everybody, everywhere. Marjorie, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Michael. Good to be back.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this because I don't want to miss a second of what you have to say. Daniel Ellsberg described the recent leaks by Edward Snowden as being of historic proportion. And rather than saying leaks, the recent, you know, shining a light on some terrible crimes, he's described that as being of historic proportions. You've talked about it as revealing an Orwellian thought police that's watching every one of us. What's the scope of all this and the significance of these latest revelations?
Well, Michael, there are two programs that Snowden revealed to both The Guardian and The Washington Post. One of them, there's a court order, a secret court order, that Verizon turn over to the National Security Agency all telephone calls in its system, both in the United States and in other countries. And this is the first time under the Obama administration that the communication records of millions of U.S. citizens are being collected, regardless of whether they're suspected of any wrongdoing. This is under the Patriot Act, and the government is collecting what they call metadata of our phone communications, and that includes the identities of the person calling, the person being called, the date, the time, the duration, the place, and unique identifiers of the communication. They say they're not reading they're not listening to the content of our calls or reading the content of the calls, so that there's no problem, no harm, no foul. But in fact, this is really profiling, because what they're using all this data for is to look for so-called patterns, which I think they can find, in some cases, and probably in most cases they can't. And what that metadata can tell about you and me, who have no connection to any kind of terrorism or crime, is our most intimate secrets. Who we call, when we call, how frequently we call. Let's say that we call repeatedly to Alcoholics Anonymous, or a hotline for gay teenagers, or an abortion clinic. Then they know a lot about us, even without listening to the content of the call. And just seeing the URL of an email, for example, or a website that you visit, can have search terms embedded within it, such as www.webmd.com/depression. And then they know that you are perhaps suffering from depression or researching depression. So this is really quite outrageous. And Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, members of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, think that this is it is not useful for intelligence collecting. They say that traditional methods have been working just fine, and they say we believe most Americans would be stunned to learn the details of what they are doing. Now, the other program is called PRISM, and what PRISM does is to get data from Google, Facebook, Yahoo, Skype, AOL, YouTube, Microsoft, PalTalk, and it allows the national security officials to collect search history, content of emails, file transfers, and live chats if it is targeted at foreigners reasonably believed to be abroad, even if the surveillance takes place on U.S. soil. And although this law under the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the amendments of 2008, although this law forbids intentionally targeting data collection at American citizens or anyone in the United States, it does allow for the targeting of any customers who live outside the U.S. or, and get this, any Americans who call or email out of the country. So if you send an email to Paris or you call your friend in Mexico, then your information can be read and listened to, and that includes the content. And this PRISM program is the primary source of raw material for the NSA, for the National Security Agency, and it accounts for 1 in 7 intelligence reports. Now, after this surveillance became public, after Edward Snowden turned over this material to the Guardian and the Washington Post, a New York Times reported on a senior intelligence official who spoke to them anonymously, who said that this PRISM actually succeeded in thwarting a 2009 plot to bomb the New York City subway system by Najibullah Zazi. But public legal documents show, according to Ben Smith at BuzzFeed and others who have confirmed it, that old-fashioned police work, not data mining, was the tool that led counterterrorism agents to arrest Zazi. So Dianne Feinstein defended this program, this massive surveillance program. She says, she admitted she didn't know how the data was being used, and the New York Times editorial called her defense absurd, and Glenn Greenwald tweeted, "The reason there are leakers is precisely because the government is filled with people like Dianne Feinstein who do horrendous things in secret." So this is very alarming, and the government is trying to make us think that, well, they're not really listening to our phone calls, and it's not Americans that this PRISM is being targeted at when they do listen to the content of phone calls and emails. It's foreigners, but certainly Americans can be swept up in it and are being swept up in it.
Tell me this, Marjorie, and well, first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Marjorie Cohn, a law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and author of The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. Now, Marjorie, in some ways, when I'm looking at this and everything that's going on with this, there's a couple of things that jump out at me, and we'll try to deal with them as we go on. But one of them is this idea that, and this is going on whether it's in drones or Guantanamo or all kinds of things, that in a big way, this is actually, to me, this emphasizes that point about, you know, this is a massive dragnet. It emphasizes the point about worse than Bush, you know, that it's really taken Bush, it's sort of squared or cubed Bush, you know, and what they were doing. And this is something that I think really has to be clear to people, because it's not just monitoring everybody's thoughts and actions, but actually it's about something more, controlling everybody's activity, thoughts, and communications.
You know, it's certainly Obama has continued a lot of the Bush policies and even it taken them to, further, such as the drone killings, et cetera. But I would be very hesitant to say that Obama is worse than Bush. Keep in mind, and I've been very critical of Obama, as you know, keep in mind that Bush started an illegal war, two illegal wars, one in Iraq, one in Afghanistan, killing hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million people, Americans and Iraqis and Afghans. Neither of those wars were necessary. Neither was legal. And we're still trying to untangle from them as much as the administration ever really wants to untangle from any foreign intervention. But so, yes, Obama is doing a lot of bad things, is taking this police state further. But, you know, Bush was illegally spying on Americans. He had data collection through his terrorist surveillance program, and it wasn't until, you know, he pressured Congress by terrorizing them, which he did many times for the Patriot Act, for the Iraq War, et cetera, that they retroactively said, well, this spying program, which violated FISA, FISA is now legal and gave immunity to the telecommunications companies. But Obama is doing things that that really are quite disturbing, but I would be hard-pressed to say he's actually worse than Bush.
Well, that's where we'll have to continue a conversation on another date, because I would really disagree with you. But anyway, I think what about this point, though, about what they're doing is not just monitoring, but actually laying the basis to control everyone's activities, thoughts, and communications?
Well, yes. I mean, by profiling, and that's what they're doing, profiling people according to patterns that they see. Some experts are saying, well, we know how to identify patterns, even if they're not listening to the contents of the call. They actually know your innermost thoughts, feelings, sexual orientation, etc. So the consequences are far-reaching, and then in the prison program, they actually do listen to or read the content if you're communicating with somebody outside the country. So, yeah, it's not just surveillance. It also will chill people. People will be less likely to express themselves. It will threaten our First Amendment rights because people will be hesitant to put out communications on Facebook, on Google, on Yahoo if they know that these companies are actually, turning over surveillance to the government, and the government can analyze it and do what they will with it. So yes, it will definitely have a chilling effect. Now, let me just tell you about a couple of lawsuits. I believe it was 7 years ago, the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York filed a lawsuit to have the Bush terrorist surveillance program, which actually ended in 2007, labeled as unconstitutional. And it went up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit actually, I think 2 days ago, threw the lawsuit out and said that, well, the Center for Constitutional Rights and their plaintiffs really could not provide any proof that the government had actually surveilled them personally. This is called standing. Were you actually harmed? Can you actually show that you were harmed? So that suit was thrown out of court. The ACLU just filed a lawsuit. This is the first lawsuit since Snowden's revelations. So the ACLU filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court in the Southern District of New York. This is the trial court at the federal court level. Challenging these two programs, these two surveillance programs, and they know that they would have to overcome this same hurdle that the CCR, Center for Constitutional Rights, was not able to overcome in the Ninth Circuit case, which is standing. But the ACLU is saying that it does have standing to sue the government over this program because it is a Verizon customer. And we know that the secret court order from the FISA court has ordered Verizon to turn over all this information. Now, chances are, if it's ordered Verizon to do so, it's ordered other telecommunications companies to do it as well. We don't have that information. It may be coming out. Glenn Greenwald says there's more to come. Who knows? But the ACLU, in its lawsuit, is saying, we have standing to sue the government over this program because we are a Verizon customer. And ACLU is also contending that the NSA surveillance will have a chilling effect on whistleblowers who would otherwise contact the ACLU for help. So there is litigation. It goes, of course, moves very, very slowly. But one of the really disturbing things, Michael, about these two programs that Snowden has revealed is that they are legal. They're legal because Congress has been bullied by the Bush administration and, not so easily by Obama, but all this stuff was set up under the Bush administration and the 2008 FISA Amendments Act and the Patriot Act, which happened, of course, under Bush, but has been reauthorized, you know, since then, every time it comes up for reauthorization. So the executive is doing this. Congress has put its stamp of approval on it, and the courts are not striking it down. So we have all three branches saying it's legal. So we can't say, well, you know, Obama's breaking the law, but we can, then it falls to we the people to say, okay, when the three branches of government are legalizing something which affects all of us and is very threatening to the very idea, the very basis of democracy, and is unnecessary. Yes, we all want to be safe, but this is overkill, and we have people like Udall and Wyden who have been reviewing secret intelligence collection operations for years. They're on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and they say this is not necessary that to do all of this, that traditional intelligence gathering methods work just fine. So, this whole balance between liberty and security, where Obama's saying, well, we can never be, 100% free because of our security, he is engaging in the same fear-mongering that we heard during the Bush administration, and it's up to us to say we are not going to stand for this.
Well, let me ask you this, Marjorie. Let me jump in here and, one, let people know that we're talking with Marjorie Cohen, law professor and author. And Marjorie, one question along those lines. One of the things that really gets me angry is that in the midst of all this, what's been revealed and what, you have a very strong sense that this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's there. And you look at that massive data collection site up in Utah, all of these things that they're doing, and, just the history of this government and what it does in along these lines. And yet, the point is there's a tremendous attempt, and even frankly, even though, yes, there's been editorials, there's been this, there's been that, but there's a lot of stuff that's even in the press in the sense of, look, there's an effort to shift the terms of discussion from what the hell? What are they doing? What is this? This is a crime to, well, the real problem is, how did he get access to these secrets? How did a low level whatever get access to these secrets? What, they brought in a flash drive and he wasn't, so there's this whole thing about, instead of having the discussion, which actually, interestingly enough, Snowden said this is one of the things he wanted to accomplish, was to get this society-wide discussion of what's going on here so people could stand up and say no, then there's a massive attempt to shift the discussion to, how did this happen? Does this indicate that there's weaknesses in our national security system?
Well, they're attacking the messenger is a tactic that the government uses frequently. They've certainly done it with Bradley Manning. Instead of saying, wait a minute, Bradley Manning revealed the commission of war crimes by the United States. War crimes are illegal. Let's bring the people to justice who committed the war crimes. They attack Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning, pleads guilty to offenses that are going to garner him 20 years for sure. That's not enough for the government. They want to send a strong message that everybody better keep their mouth shut, so they're charging him with aiding the enemy and under the Espionage Act, which will get him life in prison, overcharging. But again, attacking the messenger is, it's a tactic that they frequently use. There was the polls that came out of Americans, how Americans feel about this overwhelming surveillance, at first were showing, well, Americans weren't really opposed to it because we have to be safe. But then when the question is asked a little bit differently, and they're talking about their own communications being spied on, majority of Americans say no, they're opposed to it. So a lot of it is framing and is getting the word out through shows like yours, articles like mine, to really educate people. I think that's the first step. We have to educate people about what the real issues are. And the real issues are not, let's go after the messenger, but rather, what are they saying? There's a real sickness here, and it has to be rooted out.
Well, one of the things, I think it's really important what you're saying. And I also think, here's a point, though, too, which is, and I think it's important when you're talking about the polls and how opinion changes when the questions are worded differently. But there's an element here where really there's an attempt to whip up, even as we're, confronted with this, really disgusting thing that's going on. And like you say in your piece, the Orwellian Thought Police, there's still this attempt to sort of use it to sort of rally this kind of jingoistic, chauvinistic, patriotic, whatever, even the idea that you've spoken to about, we got to be safe and all this and how that's all just a farce. But there's also this element of, look, both of these guys, both Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden, both came up and said they had very high moral reasons for doing this. Snowden saying, I didn't want to live in a society that would do things like this. you know, Manning talking about the, you know, seeing these terrible war crimes, and both are being hit very, very hard by the system. And I think that's extremely important for people to understand. Here, you do a compare and contrast the motive of the system in carrying all this stuff out and the motive of these people who blew the whistle. Compare and contrast, and then think about what the hell does that say about the society we live in?
You're absolutely right. And the response of the Obama administration is to charge, I think already, and this is not counting what they might do to Snowden if they ever get their hands on him, six people under the Espionage Act, more than all prior presidents combined. I mean, this is overkill. And this is trying to play on people's fears, which happened right after 9/11. 9/11 was a horrific thing. It was a crime against humanity. It was not an attack by another country. And yet, the Congress, Bush rammed through Congress the Patriot Act 3 weeks after 9/11. I think it was, well, maybe it was a little more than 3.5, 4 weeks after 9/11. The Patriot Act, which really takes away so many of our rights to privacy, and the they had tried to get that through Congress, a lot of those provisions through Congress before 9/11, and Congress said no. So what's happened is that I think that we should not underestimate the power of fear. And I wrote a piece back during the Bush administration called Spinning Fear. The fear is in the room. That's what Edward R. Murrow said. And nothing to fear but fear itself, you know, FDR said. So fear is what is used. Fear was used by the Nazis to get people to go along with them. And I'm not saying that, you know, not equating Obama with the Nazis, but Obama, like Bush, is using fear to whip people up into silence, basically, whip them down into silence, I guess you can say, and not and obscure the real issues, which is not just the morality of what Snowden and Manning are revealing, but also the legality. Although yes, technically what Snowden has revealed is legal, it should not be. And you know, laws don't just fall out of the sky and all of a sudden it's legal and it's fine. Laws, many times, if you look at a lot of the laws that Congress passes, they are in response to hysteria over high-profile issues and cases. And laws can change, and certainly the Supreme Court, although, you know, when those justices are being questioned during their confirmation hearings, oh, I'm not going to let my views on the death penalty or abortion enter into my my opinions, don't believe it for a minute. They are, you know, they're political like anyone else, and that's why we can predict, not completely, but to a large extent, how different justices are going to fall on different issues. So there are, the most important thing, I think the bottom line is to keep front and center in people's minds the substance of what is underlying what these whistleblowers are doing, these incredibly courageous people. And there will be more. And I thought, boy, you know, here's Bradley Manning. You know, it was just his court-martial had just gotten underway. He's charged with crimes that could get him life in prison. And here we have Edward Snowden making revelations at incredible risks to himself. And you just have to really be in awe of that kind of courage, and this will continue, these whistleblowers, I'm sure.
All right, Marjorie, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Give people your website so they can follow what you're doing.
It's www.marjoriecohn.com, MarjorieCohn.com.
All right, Marjorie, thank you very much for joining us again, and looking forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay, Michael. Thanks. Okay. Take care.
Take care now. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Marjorie Cohn, law professor and author, and we've been talking about the Edward Snowden and the revelations he's released to the world about the massive dragnet spying operation of the U.S. imperialists. And we've been talking about also, in addition to that, the courageous actions of Bradley Manning along with that. And if you want to get involved or follow all this, go to my blog, michaelslate.wordpress.com, and you'll find links to Marjorie's site, to a tremendous little video called I Am Bradley Manning, and other support sites, and to revcom.us for the latest news and analysis. And you can leave comments, make suggestions, ask questions. That's michaelslate.wordpress.com. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
Don't skills, that alone don't count. without the sweat and toil of mine, it wouldn't be worth a dime. You got to live and give, share and care, really put some love in the air. Oh, for when your neighbor's down, try to pick him up. Nobody can live in
All right, welcome back. Let's make a better world. And that's from Tata Vega and Judith Hill, two of the backup singers that are featured in 20 Feet from Stardom. And this is taken from the soundtrack album of that film. And 20 Feet from Stardom is the newest film by filmmaker Morgan Neville. And back when I was at Sundance back in January, I had a chance to see the film. It's a remarkable film. And I wanted to play the interview that I did with Morgan for the rest of the show. So kick back, listen, enjoy, and I'll talk to you again at the end of this interview. I saw a film here at Sundance that really knocked my socks off, set me back in my seat, just had my eyes open and my ears wide open. It was a film called 20 Feet from Stardom, and it was something that, you know, as people who listen to the show regularly know, I'm a music fanatic, all kinds of music, but it's especially rooted in a lot of the music that comes up out of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then building on top of that. And this film, 20 Feet from Stardom, by director Morgan Neville, just blew my mind. It was a lot of fun. And in addition to being fun, I learned a hell of a lot about a lot of things that happened during that era and actually continue to happen to this day, both in the art form and in society in general. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, let's jump into this. I saw the title of the film and I thought, Then as I read it, I said, wow, how the hell did you come up with that concept?
Yeah, I mean, all credit has to go to my producer. Gil Friesen came up with the idea. Now, Gil used to run A&M Records. He was the president of A&M. You know, he was the ampersand in A&M, they said. And he was a cool cat. He had the idea for the documentary, and he had the title, and that was it. He actually had come up with the title. And so when I met with him, he said, okay, I want to do a documentary about backup singers. 20 Feet from Stardom's this title I have. I don't know anything more than that. And I said, that sounds amazing. You know, I love music. I've been doing music docs for, you know, 20 years now. And but I didn't know anything about backup singers. And I thought, you know, it was just some gap in my music knowledge. And as I was talking to my other music geek friends, I found out that nobody knew a whole lot about backup singers. It's just one of these areas of the music business that was kind of invisible. I mean, there are no books, there are no websites. I mean, it was kind of shocking how little was out there. And the only way for me to figure out what was going on in that world was to meet these people, and these ladies mainly. And so I went off on a journey for a few months and interviewed 50 backup singers and did oral histories with them to figure out what their lives were like, the stories and the themes, the characters. And it just blew me away. I mean, the thing I realized right away was it was a family. Backup singers, because they're session musicians, essentially, you know, they've all sung with each other. They all know each other. Not only that, they all love each other. I mean, it's this weird corner of the music business where people actually support and love each other and don't, you know, cut each other's throat. You know, I think people expect these ladies to be kind of elbowing each other out of the way, and the opposite is absolutely true, which is that these are women who their whole reason for being is about music, about giving themselves, giving up their own individual identity to make the greater whole as good as it can be.
You know, that's something that comes through very clearly and very early in your film, this whole point about they're producing a work of art, and they view themselves not as sort of addendums to the band and to the whole scene there, but actually as a critical part of it. And in so much as they do, they consider that melding in, that harmonizing, mm-hmm. that becoming one with the entire band, with the entire scene, was actually so important in the work.
It is. I mean, the one thing they all talk about is the blend, with a capital B. You know, the blend is the moment where they all come together and hit a harmony where you can't pick out the individual voices anymore. And they say when it really works, a new voice almost emerges that's a sum, and not only a sum of their voices, but something even greater than the sum of their voices. And it's something that's spiritual and it's deep and it's the thing they chase. You know, it's like they're addicted to the blend, you know, and I don't blame them. It's just a truly amazing thing to behold or to hear. And that's what it's about. It's about them saying, look, we're here to be, you know, a color in the painting. You know, we're here to blend into it and make it all as good as possible, but it's not about us. And that's something that I love celebrating in this film. You know, we don't get to celebrate people who are just givers and altruists very much, you know, and I'm glad this film gets a chance to.
The one thing that comes out too is they also consider themselves artists, and they are artists, but it's not like they're saying, okay, we're just going to work today. They're actually creating something, and I think that's one of the things that a lot of people don't understand about backup singers. It's not just the harmony in the background, and it's not just this, but there's actually this point of they're creating something. And I thought one of the trippiest stories in there was when Darlene Love was talking about how they would go in there and all the backup singers normally were these white women and who were all music readers, and then Darlene and her crew couldn't read a note of music but could sing like hell.
Exactly. You know, it was the world before these largely African-American voices came in. It was white session singers, the readers, they called them, and they read everything off of sheets, you know, and they were technically very good, but there maybe wasn't a lot of soul to their singing. And what happened really was that as these African-American voices, people like Darlene Love and the Blossoms and in New York, people like the Sweet Inspirations coming out of the churches, they were bringing something that was happening at the same time music was changing. So, you know, as the old-fashioned three-hour sessions were breaking down and the union rules and everything, and suddenly bands wanted to record all night and be looser with it and find things in the studio, they came along right at the right time. And suddenly all the new young producers, whether it was Lou Adler or Sam Cooke or all these people, wanted these singers on their sessions because they knew they could come in, they could improvise, they could swing. And, you know, it just was this perfect coming together at the right time in the right place, and it changed music. But nobody's ever really talked about it.
That's The Crystals with He's a Rebel, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Morgan Neville, the director of a great new film called 20 Feet from Stardom. And this is a film where you're going to get a chance to meet and hear from some of the greatest unsung heroes behind some of the greatest music that you're ever going to hear, okay? Let me ask you this, Morgan.
It's funny because I was interviewing somebody this morning, a filmmaker who's from England. And she does a lot of work around women, you know, the oppression of women and the conditions of women around the world. And she said, well, what film have you seen that you really liked? And I mentioned your film. And she said, I have to see that. And we started talking about it. And immediately, I mentioned Darlene Love, and she starts singing He's a Rebel. And she goes, did you know that was not The Crystals, but it was Darlene Love? I said, I do now.
Exactly. And I mean, that's the kind of story that, you know, these are largely black women. And so they deal with all the issues of gender and of race, you know. And Darlene Love, who's, you know, probably the best known backup singer there is out there. And of course, she's a lead singer in her own right and now a new inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which she deserves every bit of. You know, and I've said that most backup singers have tried to have solo careers, and if they had just happened to have that one hit, they would have been stars. We'd all know who they were because they're absolutely that good. In Darlene's case, she did have that hit. She had a number one hit with He's a Rebel, and she had major hits with, you know, Boy, I'm Gonna Marry and things like that, but they weren't under her name. I mean, she literally recorded them, and her producer, Phil Spector, put another band's name on it, The Crystals. The Crystals had never heard these songs until they were playing on the radio, and suddenly they discovered that a hit. And that was, you know, the Wild West of the music industry then, and these women, Darlene said, you know, at the time, I couldn't afford a lawyer, you know, and I didn't want to get a bad reputation in the business and not have work, and nobody knew what the kind of longevity was of all this. It was the Wild West. And so, you know, I think Darlene's story is about spending decades of her life literally trying to reclaim her name.
You know, one of the things that comes out too is that it's really interesting because as much as these women
put themselves in into the art and as part of the art, as part of the whole. There's also, they have, there's these experiences with some of these people like Phil Spector and Ike, actually. You know, Ike Turner was sort of, you know, I mean, the way it's described now, these are people who are sort of diametrically opposed just by what, everything they do to the ethos that these backup singers are operating towards.
Yeah, I mean, Phil, Ike Turner, Ray Charles. I mean, Ray, you know, you give him more credit, and Ray was the one who first really brought in a lot of and featured backup vocalists. The Raylettes were his band, and, you know, Ike Turner loved Ray Charles, and so he said, well, if Ray's going to have the Raylettes, I'm going to have the Ikettes, you know, which is perfect. And the Ikettes were the Raylettes with more sex. And, you know, but Ray and Ike and Phil, they were all egomaniacal, tough bosses. You know, and they all had their pluses and minuses, and they were all geniuses in their own way. But they weren't necessarily about sharing a lot of credit, glory, or money with these ladies. And, you know, I think part of the story is trying to share some glory with these women, because they absolutely deserve it, because they were essential to making those records and those songs and those concerts as good as they were.
Let's talk about a couple of these women. We talked about Darlene Love a little bit earlier, and if you had anything more you want to add on to that, that'd be great too. I also wanted to talk about Lisa Fisher and Mary Clayton.
Well, Mary came up under Darlene's tutelage. The thing is, when Darlene and the Blossoms got so hot, they couldn't take all the sessions that were coming their way. So Darlene started inviting other girls from the churches in South Central to come up into the studios in Hollywood. And, you know, Darlene's dad was a preacher. Mary's dad was a preacher. They all knew each other from the churches. And, you know, Mary was 14, and Darlene got her out of PE class a couple days a week to go up to Hollywood and start singing on sessions. And at 14, Mary is singing with Bobby Darin, doing a duet with Bobby Darin, which is unbelievable because she sounds like she's 30. And that was just kind of, again, them opening the door for each other. And once those doors open, you know, they never closed. So Mary came in, and she became one of the top session singers for many years. And, you know, there were a lot of other great singers, Clydie King and Shirley Matthews, Vanetta Fields, who were kind of the top-notch women, the go-to women for the session singers at the time. And Mary, you know, she sang on the first Joe Cocker record, Feeling All Right. She sang on first Neil Young solo record. But most famously, she sang on Give Me Shelter, you know, which is probably the greatest backup performance in rock history, if not music history. You know, just absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
That was Mary Clayton doing her duet with Mick Jagger on Gimme Shelter. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Morgan Neville about his new film, 20 Feet from Stardom, a story of background singers and some of the greatest music ever produced and their role in it.
You know, Mary is somebody who really, you know, she's like Aretha. She just unbelievable voice, unbelievable. You know, there's that joke about, you know, she sings so good she could sing the phone book. Well, the first time I met Mary, she opened a phone book and started singing. And, you know, I was almost crying. You know, she was so damn good. I mean, literally, she could sing you a menu and make you weep. Lou Adler, who was the hottest producer in the business at the time, he had just produced Tapestry, he signed her, he put out three albums with her that were great, you know, I have them all, and it just never caught fire like it should have, you know, it just, there was never a hit. If there had been one hit on one of those records, we'd all be talking about her. And so Mary's had to deal with that throughout her whole life, and, you know, but she's, you know, she's good at taking care of herself. The diva. She calls herself the diva. Even her granddaughter calls her grandma diva.
What about Lisa Fisher?
So Lisa Fisher, in a way, is kind of the opposite person. To me, Lisa is somebody who just has a stunning gift. One of the most incredible voices of all time. Just unbelievable ability. And she's the most intuitive, loving singer. And she put out one album because it fell, a record deal fell in her lap. She put out one album in the early 90s, and it was great. She had a hit. It won a Grammy for Best R&B Album, and, you know, she was really well-loved and respected in the industry, and her experience of being a solo star, she kind of looked around after a few months and said, you know, this isn't for me. Like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to have to worry about what I look like when I go to the market. I don't want to have to worry about my business manager. I just want to sing. And in that way, Lisa is kind of this pure embodiment of the spirit of the backup singer, which is, it's about the music, you know? And that kind of purity is just something to behold. And, you know, I love Lisa, and I'm so glad we're able to share some of her story and her spirit with an audience. You know, to me, she's kind of the soul of the film.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Morgan Neville about his new film, 20 Feet from Stardom, a story of background singers and some of the greatest music ever produced and their role in it.
You know, there's one part in the film, there's a shot you have where the editing is brilliant, and it's with Lisa, and she's in a session, and she's by herself, and then suddenly there's two of her, and then three of her, and then four of her. And you captured something really fundamental about the whole point you've been making about backup singers and their collectivizing and their individuality at the same time. So can you talk to that a little? That was just a brilliant shot, man.
Yeah, I mean, Lisa, I'd heard that Lisa had done a choir by herself before. You know, somebody wanted a full choir, and Lisa said, yeah, I did that. You know, I sang 30 different voices on a track and, you know, stood in different positions around the mic, and I said, I've got to get Lisa to do this. And I asked her to pick a piece. She picked this amazing Samuel Barber vocal piece. And she sang. She just sat there and she layered all the different parts on. And it's amazing. I mean, to me, that scene says a lot of things. In part, it's what is recording these days, which is people, you know, a lot of people don't hire backup singers anymore because, you know, on their laptop, they can lay down 30 tracks. And why pay four singers to come in? You can have one come in and do it, you know, over and over. But there's also a kind of, and there's certainly beauty to her ability, but there's to me, a sadness to that moment of the film, because it's a different thing. Singing with yourself is not it's not a blend. You know, it's a different kind of blend. It's not people coming together. It's people singing with themselves. And you know, Lisa's fantastic at it. But the top singers these days, you know, Adele or Florence and the Machine, I mean, kind of big vocal singers these days, they do all of their own backup vocals. You know, I've talked to the producer, Paul Epworth, who produces both of them, and he said, you know, they'll send him a hard drive with 60 vocal tracks and that's all he needs. You know, and that's where we're at today in the industry and in technology and everything else. But something's lost in that bargain. Not that those aren't great songs and things, but it's not the same.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Morgan Neville about his new film, 20 Feet from Stardom, a story of background singers and some of the greatest music ever produced and their role in it.
I want to move into another part of your film, which is when a door opened for them with the 60s, the 70s. I asked this question the other day in the screening, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, a whole new world opened up. Including in these women being treated, I thought, at least that's what it implied in your film, treated by these artists like Sting and Joe Cocker and frankly even Mick Jagger, who has this horrible reputation and everything else. But the way that they viewed the backup singers, the way they viewed the women was actually as an important part of the band, an important part of the work, and actually the creativity that was allowed to flow like that. You have these great scenes where Sting is telling, I can't remember who, but he's telling her, think of this, and he describes an emotion, and she just runs with it, you know. And you see this collaboration, and her art shining. Mm-hmm. And they said that this actually even, one of them said that this really saved their life in relation to the art. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, I mean, first of all, with these English artists, you know, we all talk about the British Invasion, and of course, all of these bands, the Stones and Cocker and everybody who, Zeppelin, who loved American blues and roots music and soul music. And when they started coming to America, they wanted to be black artists. They wanted to be blues artists. They wanted to be Muddy Waters or Helen Wolf. The closest thing they could get to that was getting black singers to sing on stage with them. And I think when they finally started realizing, hey, we can record in America and we can actually get these people to sing with us, to them, that lent them authenticity, but it also elevated these singers. You know, at the time, they were doing session work, and most of the time they're told to kind of tone it down and stick to the script, as it were. And, you know, some of these great gospel singers, you know, they're singing on records by Mamas the Papas or Perry Como or Nancy Sinatra or whomever, but it's not quite showing the capacity of what they can sing. So when people like Cocker and the Stones and Zeppelin and everybody else came in and just said, go for it, it completely opened up their lives. I mean, Gloria Jones says that in the film. It saved their lives. And that was a major innovation in rock music at the time and in the story of backup singing. You know, and that's part of kind of the background of our film, is just giving you a sense of how backup singing's grown up throughout these past 50 years.
Let's talk about the other aspect of this thing I was asking the other day, the impact, the synergy between what was going on in the late 60s, mid-60s, late 60s, the early 70s, even to a certain extent, the late 50s, when doo-wop was actually out there big. And, you know, the fact that doo-wop had a major impact on, frankly, a huge impact on the white audience. And it began to break down a lot of the divisions between black and white people, especially youth. And it also troubled a lot of white parents, right, who were like, my daughter's really getting into this music by these young black guys, you know, and she loves them. There was this whole social context to this thing that was breaking open at the time, a lot around race, but a lot around just getting rid of all the old mores and all the old chains that were holding people. And it seemed that this had a big impact on people. I was thinking in particular with Mary Clayton and her stories about how that interacted with her. But in general, that seemed to have a big impact on what was being done and what was open for people.
Well, what I think is interesting is as the rise of the doo-wop, or in the early 60s, the rise of the girl groups, you know, there were a lot of fantastic black bands, you know, and whether we're talking about the Drifters, the Shirelles, or whomever, you know, these great bands. But they were, you know, all black bands, and then there were all white bands. And where the backup singers are interesting is that they were black singers singing with white bands. You know, it was really the kind of first mixing of races in the studio. And that's interesting, figuring that these black singers like Darlene and the Blossoms, they're singing with Bobby Darin, they're singing with Frank Sinatra, they're singing then with Nancy Sinatra and Tom Jones and all these singers, that they're showing up in the studio and changing things in a way. You know, they're no longer ghettoized to just being the black artists or the white artists. They're bringing the black voices to the white artists and literally changing that sound at the same time. And that was important. And that's something, you know, I've never really heard people talk that much about. And one funny story I have to tell you that Darlene said, because they're doing all these white sessions, and she got called to do a Sam Cooke session. And they went into the studio, and Sam Cooke was shocked when they walked in. Because Sam Cooke, of course, all these sessions he's doing, everybody's white. And he never imagined there would be anybody else black showing up in the studio. So when he did, it was like, oh my God, here we go, about time, you know.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Morgan Neville about his new film, 20 Feet from Stardom, a story of background singers and some of the greatest music ever produced and their role in it. Let's talk about Mary Clayton and Sweet Home Alabama and the rebellious spirit that she took up in relation to that, which I think was a product of the times as well as her own personality.
Yeah, I mean, Sweet Home Alabama is obviously a controversial song. You know, Mary, just going back for a sec, you know, she sang on Neil Young's first album, and on her first solo album, she covered Southern Man, you know, and really did a great job with it.
Southern man, you better keep your head. Don't forget what your good book said. Southern change is gonna come at last. Now your crosses are burning fast. Southern man, yeah.
Year or two later, she gets a call to come do this session for some guy named Leonard Skinner, as she says, and to do a song called Sweet Home Alabama. And, you know, as much as she might want the session money, you know, she was not at all comfortable with the message of that film. And but her husband convinced her that doing the work and doing it as good as you could possibly do it was in and of itself a statement. And I think a lot of singers looked at it that way, that they're embracing the traditions of what they came from, the church and the gospel, and just being as amazing as they were really made its own statement, you know, left its own fingerprints in the music.
Well, also, frankly, the things that you cut into the film, too, at that point, which was really made the point, all these endless repetitions of the Panthers and the Black Power movement and the struggle against all this, you really brought to life what was going on at that time period and the impact that it had on people and what people were trying. I mean, the fact that people could even think about identifying with that kind of movement and saying, instead of just like, I'm doing this as a job, leave me alone, which so many people do today, you know, it's like, it's just my job, man. I don't believe it. It's just my job. But she actually looked at it and said, I'm not doing that. She says, you want your Southern man? I'll give you, I'll give you Sweet Home Alabama, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was real. I thought that was a brilliant move on your part.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's true. I mean, we're talking the early 70s and all this stuff was going on. And, you know, this was their part in the struggle for civil rights and African-American rights and respect. You know, it's just something that I don't think you ever think about when you hear a song, but like Sweet Home Alabama, that you've heard for 40 years, mm-hmm. You know, suddenly you think, God, you're right. There were these women standing there in the studio singing this song and what was going through their minds and what are they saying? And you know, it just brings a whole new shading to music that way.
Now, there's one other person in the film, and she made a point about that, you know, a lot of backup singers, as you've been saying, are being a backup singer is what they're going to do. That's their art. That's where they're at. And she said that backup singing can be a step, can be a boost, it can be a step up, but it can also be quicksand if you don't deal with it right. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that makes you a great lead singer, having a strong personality and image and ego, a brand, you know, all these things they talk about in music today, is in fact the thing that makes you a bad backup singer. And in a way, they're two diametrically opposed skill sets. So to be a backup singer, it's all about losing your individuality. And it's not about you. It's about making somebody else look good. And, you know, to be a star, you know, it's all about making you look good. And, you know, to me, that's the tension between, you know, all of these singers. And certainly there have been a lot of great backup singers that have made the transition from the back to the front. And whether that's Dionne Warwick or Mary J. Blige or Luther Vandross or Sheryl Crow or Cher, or, you know, all these people that have done it over the years, it's not easy. And it's very easy to get branded as a backup singer. And in a way, you know, I think the public and labels, I think there's both the outside perception that, you know, because you do that, that you're maybe don't have the personality to be a lead singer. And at the same time, the amount of effort you invest in being a backup singer is not effort you're investing in being a star either and being a lead singer. So it's a tricky thing to navigate. And I've heard both opinions from backup singers as to whether or not you should cold turkey on backup singing if you really want to be a star or not. Because I've heard singers say, absolutely not. Take every job you can. And if you're great, you'll shine. So, you know, it's a tricky thing to navigate. And I think, you know, younger singer like Judith Hill, who's in our film, I think she's grappling with that same thing these women have gone through. And I think watching this film and spending this time with all these women who've gone through what she's gone through, they've gone through before, what she's now going through, has really helped her. You know, it's interesting. And I, you know, I have big hopes and for Judith, because she's incredibly talented. But it's not easy.
One last question. It's the sort of, you kind of open up the film with Springsteen. And he makes that comment, and I was thinking about this when you were talking about the title for the film coming from your producer. He makes the comment about the distance from the drum kit to the front of the stage. And he talks about that, walking that distance, and he's referring to the position of the backup singers in that. And it's something actually you can see, and you could see in the evolution of his work, you could see how that distance can be huge or it can be small. And a lot of times in his case, it's small because he really brings them into the thing. And there's this back and forth that just never ends. So can you talk about that as the last question?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting with somebody like Springsteen, who's been using more and more backup vocalists. His last tour, you know, they're heavily featured. You know, it's like he's getting into it, which is great. I love to see that. But more than 20 feet, you know, it's a psychological divide. And I think it's something that each of these women do a dance with. Some of them are so used to disappearing in the spotlight, and they're comfortable with that. But for others, to be back by the drum riser and watch somebody in front of you who's maybe not as good a singer as you are or as talented as you are as you think, you know, that can be torture to the right person. And I feel like most backup singers who feel that way can't stay in the business. It's just too heartbreaking. But some of them do, and it's, you know, it's 20 feet is a long way.
All right, Morgan Neville, thank you very much for the interview today and for the film, man. A really great film. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, we got to get out of here in a real short period of time. So you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with filmmaker Morgan Neville about his new film, 20 Feet from Stardom. And I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to follow me, you can do so on Twitter or Facebook. If you want to check out my blog, you can at michaelslate.wordpress.com. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from Mick Jagger and Mary Clayton and Gimme Shelter.